This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. In the last week, there has been a wave of suicide bombings in Chechnya, in Morocco, Saudi Arabia, and Israel. The latest was in northern Israel today, the fifth there in 2 days. On Friday, 41 people died after a series of explosions in Morocco. Those blasts hit five separate locations in the city of Casablanca. Those blasts come less than a week after dozens were killed in Saudi Arabia. The attacks in Casablanca and Riyadh were both well coordinated, and several bombs detonated at right around the same time. Earlier today, as he met with the president of the Philippines, another country involved in the war on terrorism, President Bush spoke with reporters about the latest attacks.
First of all, I have said this is going to be, always said this is going to be a long war. That it's not only a long war, a new kind of war. We're trying to chase down people who hide and move around in the dark corners of the world, and they plot and they plan and then they pop up and kill. They don't care about innocent life. And we're making progress. I mean, we are slowly but surely dismantling the Al-Qaeda operational network. But we've got a lot of work to do, which means we've got to continue to work together to share information, cut off money, share intelligence, and hunt these people down and get them before they get us.
Now, that is a considerably different tone than the president struck when he spoke from the deck of the aircraft carrier USS Abraham Lincoln when he said that Al-Qaeda was on the run. As yet, there is no confirmation that Al-Qaeda is responsible for the blasts, but the Saudi government says it believes Al-Qaeda is to blame for the explosions in Riyadh. Moroccan officials said today there was no international involvement in the attacks in Casablanca. Later this hour, we'll talk about Israel, but now our focus is on Al-Qaeda. What sort of shape is this deadly organization in these days? How has its structure, its leadership, and its basing changed since September the 11th? To get in on the conversation, give us a phone call. Our number in Washington is 800-989-8255, 800-989-TALK. The email address is TOTN at NPR.org. And joining us now is NPR correspondent Mike Schuster at our studios at NPR West. Good to have you back on the show, Mike.
Thanks, Neil.
To those who follow terrorist activities, how surprising was the attack in Morocco?
I honestly don't think it was all that surprising, especially after the blasts in Saudi Arabia. Up until last week, a lot of terrorism experts, former counterterrorism officials from the FBI and the CIA, were cautiously saying that the wave of arrests that had taken place over the last 6 months had put Al-Qaeda on the run. But when the bombs went off in Riyadh and then in Morocco, I think that some experts were surprised that these things happened in sequence.
Mm-hmm.
But there has been an awareness of possible Al-Qaeda cells or loosely affiliated terrorist groups to Al-Qaeda in Morocco, in Saudi Arabia, and virtually all the nations in between, that I doubt that a lot of experts would say, well, we're surprised that there were these blasts in Morocco.
Now, I think it was the Justice Minister of Morocco said today that all of those involved in the explosions there were Moroccans and there was no international involvement. So there has been talk of two organizations in that country, as you suggested, loosely affiliated with Al-Qaeda.
Well, you know, to tell you the truth, Neil, I don't think that we can take any comment over the last couple of days, any single comment from a Moroccan official of any kind, trusted entirely, because there have been so many different reports coming out of Morocco that, as you say, these were all homegrown attackers. There have been reports that, in fact, they weren't, that there were a couple who came from other countries, or that the Moroccans who carried out the attacks had been in other countries and had recently returned to Morocco. And the fact that they were well coordinated, that they had a lot of explosives. There was clearly training involved. There probably was a good deal of planning involved. As the investigation goes forward, we will probably learn that there were some surveillance by these attackers of the sites over the course of weeks, if not months. And that suggests that there was training, possibly training, outside of Morocco. So I think we need to wait and learn a whole lot more before we come to any serious conclusions about who carried out the attacks in Morocco or the possibility that Al-Qaeda might not have done it.
Now, it was Morocco was mentioned in a recent tape alleged to be in the voice of Osama bin Laden.
That's right. The last, if my memory serves correctly, the last audio tape that's purported to be Osama bin Laden before the Iraq War called on his followers to attack American targets in support of the Iraqi people, but also called on his supporters to attack apostate governments in the Islamic world, and specifically mentioned Saudi Arabia, Pakistan, Morocco, and I think Jordan, I'm not sure. And essentially, the calling on his followers to attack those governments that were closely working with the United States. And this notion of apostate is an important distinction that bin Laden has made throughout his career and in many audio and videotapes, that apostates are viewed as equally evil to infidels because they were Muslims, but they, in the view of bin Laden, have abandoned the Islamic faith and therefore are legitimate targets for radical Islamists or Islamic fundamentalists.
Morocco has been a longtime ally of the United States and has been very cooperative in the war on terrorism, has it not?
That's what the American officials say. In fact, there have been a lot of Moroccans that have been picked up in the nearly 2 years since the September 11th attacks for other plots in Morocco, for some plots in Europe. There are Moroccans that have been in cells in Spain and in France, for two countries in Europe, as well as other North Africans. And so, in fact, yes, there has been some fear that Moroccans have been involved in this worldwide terrorist network. In fact, last year there was a plot apparently foiled to in Morocco to attack U.S. and British warships in the Straits of Gibraltar, a la the USS Cole attack that had taken place in 2000. So U.S. counter-terrorist officials and investigators have known about the possibility of these kind of terrorists in Morocco for quite some time.
Now, what about the attacks in Saudi Arabia? More evidence towards Al-Qaeda there?
Yeah, in fact, there are some who wonder whether, in fact, it wasn't bin Laden or some of the now senior Al-Qaeda officials outside Al-Qaeda figures outside of Saudi Arabia that ordered this attack. There have been several arrests in Saudi Arabia, and there's focus on a couple of known opponents of the Saudi royal family in Saudi Arabia, and a deep suspicion now that Al-Qaeda was calling the shots when those bombs went off in Riyadh.
Well, joining us now from his office in Los Angeles is Brian Jenkins. He's a senior advisor to the president of the RAND Corporation. His reports include Countering Al-Qaeda and Deterrence and Influence in Countering Terrorism. And Brian Jenkins, good of you to be with us on Talk of the Nation.
Thank you very much.
How does Al-Qaeda compare to what it was on 9/11?
Well, this is a changeling. It's already adapting to the new, more difficult operating environment. I mean, I think some of the things that we're seeing in this latest attack suggest that. While we have made progress in arresting a number of the leaders and destroying the bases in Afghanistan itself, Al-Qaeda has not been inactive during this time. It has continued to communicate. It has preserved some of its top leadership. Those who arrested were planning operations when they were arrested, and so it goes on. How does it differ? I think it is trying to develop a mode of operations that will provide it with better clandestinity. I think in some of these operations we're going to see the greater use of local capability as opposed to bringing terrorist teams in. For example, 9/11, 19 terrorists were brought from outside of the country into the United States in the attacks in Riyadh and in Morocco. Those appear to have been carried out largely by local elements.
But under coordination from Al-Qaeda?
Well, you know, this always gets murky. When these things are described, we talk about people who are connected with or in collaboration with The degree of connectivity is always a bit murky here. We're not talking about something that is a rigidly hierarchical organization. We're rather talking about a network, a series of relationships. To be sure, Al-Qaeda inspires the attacks. It may instigate the attacks. It may actually commission some specific attacks, but that's not so clear. Now, Al-Qaeda's top leadership clearly was at the helm in the 9/11 attacks. In some of these others, that degree of involvement is not so clear.
Our phone number is 800-989-8255, 800-989-TALK. Our email address is totn@npr.org. And Camille joins us from Charleston, South Carolina.
Hi.
Hi.
I have a question or commentary, I guess. It looks like the war on terrorism is going to essentially be a repeat of the war on drugs. You have a fluid network, and I'm wondering if we can expect the same level of non-success.
Brian Jenkins, obviously different motivations in the war on drugs and the war on terrorism, but tremendous profits driving the war on drugs, or at least one side of it. Is it the same in the war on terrorism?
Well, let's go back to language here, because getting the language precise is extremely important. The administration has spoken about the war on terrorism. That's probably an inappropriate use of the term war, except in this very broad way that we Americans are inclined to wage war on drugs, wage war on inflation, wage war on terrorism. We overuse that term.
The metaphor is what you're talking about.
The word war. We are engaged, to be sure, in a specific campaign against those responsible for 9/11, those terrorist organizations with global reach. We could say legitimately that we are at war with Al-Qaeda or its successors. But when we talk about the war on terrorism, we're talking about a much broader phenomenon. We have been dealing with that already for decades. And I think it's probably more appropriate to use the term combating terrorism. The word combating implies an enduring task, and your caller is absolutely correct. This is something that has gone on for decades and probably will continue for decades.
Well, and I guess my question, too, is when you cut one head off, one or two grow back, and will not that same thing happen with terrorism?
Well, it is a hydra in that sense. But we shouldn't wrap ourselves around the notion of organization with a capital O. You know, in the war on drugs, we had this notion if we could wipe out the Medellin cartel.
Or Pablo Escobar. Yeah.
Or Pablo Escobar, we would end the drug trade. This is a much broader phenomenon. And the fact is that whatever successes we have in destroying Al-Qaeda, whatever the fate is of Osama bin Laden, that the terrorism that represents Muslim unrest and aggressive jihadism is going to remain a significant force in Europe, in Asia, in the Middle East for many years to come.
Camille, thanks very much for the question.
Thank you.
Appreciate the phone call. If you'd like to join the conversation, our phone number is 800-989-8255, 800-989-TALK. Our email address is totn@npr.org. We're speaking with Brian Jenkins of the RAND Corporation, who's an expert on terrorism and counterterrorism, and with NPR's Mike Schuster, who's at our bureau in Los Angeles, NPR West, about this latest wave of attacks, Chechnya, Saudi Arabia, Morocco, and later in the program we'll focus on the series of attacks that have occurred in the state of Israel, 5 in the last 2 days, the most recent just earlier today, with 4 reported dead and more than a dozen injured. Back after a short break, I'm Neil Conan. You're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. We're talking about the wave of terrorist attacks over the past week and what they may say about the strength of al-Qaeda. Our guests are NPR's Mike Schuster in our NPR West studios and Brian Jenkins, who tracks al-Qaeda for the RAND Corporation. Our phone number, 800-989-8255, 800-989-TALK, and our email address, totn@npr.org. Before the break, we were talking about how al-Qaeda has changed since 9/11. Obviously, one of the great changes is the loss of headquarters and military training facilities in Afghanistan. Mike Schuster, over the weekend, there were reports of an al-Qaeda command cell based in Iran.
There were, but in fact, those are not new reports, Neil. There were reports last year that that several of al-Qaeda's senior figures had left Afghanistan during the U.S. war there and had fled to Iran. The Iranian government denied that. And for a number of months, it seemed that it wasn't that it was an argument somewhat with among U.S. investigators as to whether, in fact, significant number of al-Qaeda figures, important ones, were operating out of Iran. Now those reports have surfaced, and a lot of unnamed U.S. Investigators and counterterrorism officials are saying that there may be as many as a dozen al-Qaeda figures there. But it's a puzzle. It's not clear what the United States is meaning to say by this, whether the government of Iran is harboring them, or whether they have moved across the border from Afghanistan and found places that where they could hole up and survive. So I think it still is very puzzling whether, in fact, there is an important al-Qaeda cell that has become the operational leadership of the organization actually in Iran.
And Brian Jenkins, there is still a residual al-Qaeda operational capacity, we're told, in that fuzzy area on the borders between Pakistan and Afghanistan.
Oh, there has always been a very strong base of popular support for the Taliban in that area. For al-Qaeda, some of these things are based upon tribal links, on religious fervor. Keep in mind that Pakistan itself exploited its connections with the Taliban, with al-Qaeda, to provide a base for training those Kashmiri separatists who were determined to carry on a violent struggle in India. So there are decades and decades of support for the people up there, and no doubt they have been able to move back and forth across the border.
Let's go now to Gary, who joins us on the line from Memphis, Tennessee.
Neil, great show.
Thank you.
Question about Osama bin Laden. He's reported to be a very wealthy person. And my question is, where does he keep his money? Have those accounts been shut down? Or is it assumed that this guy carries this money around with him? And is that money still important? Or is he just more of a spiritual figurehead for al-Qaeda?
Mike, you want to try that?
Well, Neil, yeah, I mean, bin Laden has been said to have been a rich individual all along, but after September 11th, the United States Treasury got involved in organizing a worldwide effort to shut down terrorist funding and the conduits around the world that al-Qaeda used to send money around the world. And the U.S. government, the Bush administration, claims that it's shut down over $100 million in assets of al-Qaeda. But it's very murky. And when you talk to different officials, you get different thoughts about this. Some say this has been a successful area of enterprise. Some say that, in fact, it has the U.S. effort has not done much good in shutting down this conduit for money. And so it's really hard to get a bead on it. It's fairly clear that from the incidents in Morocco and in Saudi Arabia, that these attackers had a lot of ammunition, a lot of weapons, and a lot of explosives, especially in the case in Riyadh. A couple of weeks before the bombs went off, Saudi police had seized hundreds of pounds of explosives from a group that eventually carried out these bombings, and still they had enough to set off the bombs that they did. So there is funding in individual places for these kind of attacks. What we don't know is whether it's coming from outside, and if so, how much is coming from outside.
May I ask a second question real quickly?
Sure, Gary, go ahead.
Is Hezbollah considered a terrorist organization with global reach, or are they considered something else, and why aren't we going after them as well?
Brian Jenkins?
Hezbollah certainly is considered a terrorist organization, and it certainly does have global reach. Why aren't we going after them the same way we have gone after Al-Qaeda? Because the situation is a bit more complicated with Hezbollah. There are some in the administration who said that, you know, once we make further progress with Al-Qaeda, that we will take on all of these terrorist organizations worldwide, one after another. Certainly Hezbollah has what many regard as a blood debt to this country, having been responsible for killing more Americans than any other terrorist organization, at least prior to September 11th.
Those were the bombings in Beirut.
Those were the bombings in Beirut. Others say that, look, this Hezbollah is both a legitimate political party. It's an enterprise that has not, since the 1980s, sought to behave this way against the United States, that what we have done against Al-Qaeda represents an object lesson. And while there certainly are components within Hezbollah, thugs, that we will try to go after because of their crimes against the United States, we are not going to launch military operations against every terrorist group in the world. We'd just be fighting in too many places at once.
And Mike, there is evidence that the United States is putting at least diplomatic pressure on Syria, which is a very powerful influence in Lebanon, to clamp down on the activities of Hezbollah and Hamas.
That's right. Diplomacy after the Iraq war in connection with Hezbollah may, in fact, be quite useful. And the United States has put pressure both on Syria and on Iran, which are the sponsors of Hezbollah in southern Lebanon. Hezbollah is made up of Shiite Muslims, to think about what happened in Iraq and what the changed strategic context is in the Middle East with more than 150,000 American troops now in Iraq. And that might do the trick as we watch the Palestinian-Israeli conflict play out over the next half year and what role Hezbollah may choose to play or how it may choose to adjust itself within Lebanon.
It just seems unreasonable that
Gary, it
just seems unreasonable that Hezbollah has any real credibility as a negotiating figure or as a negotiating organization. It just doesn't seem right.
Hezbollah has a very important political status in Lebanon. It may not seem right to Americans when they think about this, but it's a very important political party within Lebanon, and it has to be taken into account. You remember that Lebanon was just ravaged by civil war for 20 years, and Hezbollah played a role, as did other radical Shiites, and they have to be taken into account in the Lebanese political context.
Gary, thanks very much.
Thank you.
Okay. Let's go on now to talk with Nassis, who's on the line from San Francisco. I hope I pronounced your name correctly.
Yes, Nassis. Hello, how are you?
Very well, thanks.
So I just came back from Morocco, and, you know, I think the government emphasized too much religion, you know. Like they are putting microphones in the mosque, and you cannot even sleep. And if you go to the police station, you know, they will arrest you if you ask that the microphone is loud. And also too much corruption. And if we attack these governments, and if the U.S. government push pressure on them, I think we can defeat Al-Qaeda very much, you know, indirectly. I think we have to be a little bit deep in this. I think there's too much corruption and too much emphasis on religion. And I happened to be there during the war, and, you know, the television was always vilifying the U.S. And, you know, they were playing like if Saddam was a saint, and they didn't like that. So...
Well, Brian Jenkins, I don't know if you're an expert on Morocco, but certainly a lot of these attacks seem to be directed at these governments, whether the purpose is, as Mike was telling us earlier, because in bin Laden's terminology they are apostates and not Islamic enough, or because of they are not ruled as well as the people who are attacking them would like them to be.
Well, there's no question. There's no question that Al Qaeda takes advantage of all of these discontents in the Islamic communities. Whether these discontents are about the government not being sufficiently Islamic, not following the true path, or whether the complaints are about corruption, whether the issues are simply the lack of employment and poverty. I mean, a number of these people that have been identified in the Morocco bombing came out of a slum area in Casablanca. Some of the recruiting that we see having taken place in Europe is coming out of the communities of immigrants that have been marginalized economically, that are in some of these rougher neighborhoods around Paris and some of the other cities. Some of the recruiting takes place in prison. So wherever there is discontent, lack of opportunity, anger about corruption, angry about substandard zeal being demonstrated by the government, those are the fertile recruiting grounds for Al-Qaeda.
Here's an email question we got from Troy in Iowa City. I was wondering if your panelists could share their opinion on the ability of Al-Qaeda and similar organizations to recruit. Has it become easier or more difficult for these organizations to attract new members? And if Troy wouldn't mind, I'd like to tack on an additional question on that. And to train new members without these bases in Afghanistan. Brian Jenkins?
Well, the recruiting has continued, and keep in mind that Al-Qaeda will basically exploit every possible cause it can to ensure a continuing flow of recruits, whether it's the situation in the Middle East between Israel and the Palestinians, or whether it's the war in Iraq, which certainly Al-Qaeda identified as a recruiting opportunity. Not that Al-Qaeda was an ally of Saddam Hussein, far from it, but certainly Al-Qaeda knew that the war was going to provoke a degree of resentment and hostility among some people in the Islamic world, and they were going to move to exploit that. So the recruiting has continued, undoubtedly. Now, as to the training camps, the issue in the training camps, as I see it, was not so important from the standpoint of actually providing the instruction. The instruction can be provided through training manuals, through to conduct training. You can do it in an apartment. You can do it in a garage. You don't need a big, elaborate infrastructure to conduct the kind of training to build a car bomb or to carry out some of these other attacks. The importance of the training camps was something else. And that was by bringing these recruits from all over the world, it was a test, first of all, of their level of commitment for them to leave their ordinary lives, travel to Afghanistan, and then once in the camps, they shared hardships, they met other people from other parts of the Islamic world. It was a bonding experience. It was an opportunity for indoctrination, and it was that aspect, the psychological aspect, the indoctrination aspect, as opposed to the instruction, which was greatly important. And a real question going forward is, absent having those training camps through which tens of thousands of people passed through in the years before we shut them down in Afghanistan, can Al-Qaeda create the same kind of bonding and loyalty that it created by using those training camps?
Brian Jenkins, thanks very much.
Thank you.
Brian Jenkins is a senior advisor to the president of the RAND Corporation, and some of the reports he's co-authored include Countering Al-Qaeda and Deterrence and Influence in Countering Terrorism. He was with us from his office in Los Angeles. You're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. Mike Schister, before we let you go, we want to talk about the five suicide bombings that have hit Israel in the last couple of days. How are these latest attacks being interpreted by the United States?
I think without a doubt they're being seen by nearly everybody as an attempt to undermine the peace process, the issue of the roadmap, as it even takes its first tiny step. Israel's Prime Minister, Ariel Sharon, and the new Prime Minister of the Palestinians, Mahmoud Abbas, met on Saturday night. The first bombs went off before that. Then again today, Sharon was to see President Bush in Washington this week. He's now canceled his trip, and he is again demanding that the Palestinians stop the violence, that the Palestinian Authority and the new prime minister stop this kind of violence before any discussions can take place over implementing the roadmap. So it's being seen as a real attack on even the remotest possibility that a new peace process could begin.
Is it an attack also on the new Palestinian Prime Minister, Mahmoud Abbas?
Certainly, it can be seen as that. One of the requirements of the roadmap, particularly put forward by President Bush, is that Mahmoud Abbas will have to take control of the security apparatus of the Palestinian Authority and shut down the attackers from Hamas, Islamic Jihad, and others. These attacks could be seen as acts of defiance to Mahmoud Abbas, essentially saying, if you think that you're in any way capable of shutting us down, think again.
At the same time, it's at least in some interpretations, lets Ariel Sharon off the hook. He doesn't have to take any steps towards concessions, any of the steps outlined in the roadmap, as long as he can say, look, we're still being attacked.
That's certainly true. He doesn't have to make any concessions whatsoever vis-a-vis the roadmap. But there's also the issue of whether Israel can stop these kind of attacks through its military apparatus and its occupation of Palestinian cities and Palestinian territories, which Ariel Sharon said that he could, and he was reelected as prime minister overwhelmingly based on the belief that his military strategy would work. And now you have the first almost baby step toward a new peace process, and five attacks in 2-3 days is I think a shock to the Israeli public as much as it is to us outside, and raises again important questions about Ariel Sharon's domestic strategy.
And at the same time, from the Palestinian side, people say those who to some degree supported these attacks say, what peace process? We still have Israeli troops occupying us. Military operations are still underway. Palestinians are still being killed. What's there to support?
What's the point of this? But polls have been showing that a majority of Palestinians are tired of this war with the Israelis, are tired of these kind of attacks, and have lost a belief that this kind of violence is going to get them anywhere. So if the process can actually start and the new Palestinian prime minister can show from his interactions with Sharon that he might be able to bring some benefits to the lives of Palestinian civilians who have been living in this violence for nearly 3 years now, it's possible that that some progress actually could be made, which is another suggestion of why those who are so committed to undermining the peace process wanted to set off as many bombs as they did over the last few days.
NPR's Mike Schuster, thanks very much.
You're welcome, Neil.
Mike Schuster was with us from the studios of NPR West in Culver City, California. When we come back from the break, a primer on Aceh, an embattled province of the world's most populous Muslim state, Indonesia. Warfare broke out there today. I'm Neil Conan. It's the Talk of the Nation from NPR News.